my favourite part of the week. And for book club today, I'm delighted to welcome a local author, Sarah Naidoo. She's a 26-year-old writer from Durban. She has previously published short stories, but more recently she gave birth to her debut novel, which is called A Remedy for Death. Now, this book is set across dual timelines, one of them playing out in 1972, the other in 2072. And as you can guess from a book with a century's worth of lifespans, it's partly science fiction. It's also partly gothic horror, I think you could say. It's mainly human drama, though, at its very core. And if you sympathised with the monster in Frankenstein, if you also felt pity for its creator, you are going to enjoy the story of another mad scientist whose obsession with his work pushes him beyond the boundaries of accepted ethics. Sarah, congratulations on the publication of your first novel, and thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Hi, Papa. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with a bit of a plot and character introduction for our listeners. And if we may, we'll begin in 2072, where the book does. Your protagonist, Roshana Peterson, a journalist, severely depressed, on the verge of suicide. She's sent to a small town in KwaZulu-Natal to investigate the story of a scientist who lived there a century before, Dr. Igor Evermore. And he literally saved the world when he invented a vaccine to counter the worm, as it was called, this mysterious parasite that was killing people by the millions in 1972. So discovers the vaccine, but before he can enjoy his Nobel Prize, he takes his own life. Tell us a little bit more about how Roshana is drawn into this century-old story.
So Roshana was initially added to the draft, I think maybe in the third draft.
Really?
in order to add more depth, I guess, to the story. And when I wrote Roshana, I feel like I ended up really projecting a lot of myself into her. And I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at 21.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that, or maybe living with it for this long, I've realized that negative thoughts and things like suicidal ideation become just an everyday thing, and it can almost become almost an inconvenience. And that's what it's become for Roshana in the story, where she's having all of these feelings, but she's still continuing with life as normal. Mm. And when it came to that little monologue at the beginning of the story with that first line, I learned that you don't tell people you're suicidal. I was trying to open up conversation and maybe normalize conversations about mental illness and suicide with her.
Okay. Now, she draws us back into the former storyline of 1972, where we meet somebody else and some other characters who are also grappling with their own immense emotional distress in very, very different ways. It is a theme that runs through both of the storylines, not just Roshana's one, because in 1972, we meet the eccentric Dr. Evermore and his new intern, Bongani Bantu, a young man with big aspirations to make a difference in the world. He's taken on this job to work with this incredible a scientist, is excited about what he might discover, is excited to believe that he might be part of the effort to save the globe from this terrible pandemic. But what he finds on arrival is not what he was hoping for. He is assigned menial duties, his main priority being to see to the lunch orders every day and to feed the dog and the jellyfish. He's not even allowed into the mysterious lab. But mysterious it is. Sarah, this is where it gets into the real gothic elements of the story. Like all gothic tradition, we have locked rooms that must be explored and a discovered diary and a family portrait that hints at darkness in the past and strange sounds in the night. I mean, it's eerie and chilling, and it's got all those elements you expect from a gothic novel. You must have had so much fun playing within that genre. Is it one that you enjoyed as a reader?
I was really inspired by Mary Shelley's Frankenstein when I read it. I thought it was amazing. I loved how there was a transition from a very good intention that Victor Frankenstein had at the beginning, and how it kind of had ambition kind of corrupt that good intention throughout the novel. And I did that with Dr. Evermore as well.
Yeah.
I ended up also reading I read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a lot of really classic gothic fiction. And I then found it difficult to find books that were written now that were within that genre. Hmm. So I said that I would write one, I guess. Yeah.
I'm so glad you did, because I'm somebody who loved that that genre during my own English studies, and it was so exciting to feel myself drawn back into that. I mean, everybody loves a good mystery, but it's the creepiness of the setting and the mad scientist upstairs, and but as you say, coupled with the very human issues that the mad science throws into a different light. Now, speaking of the science, I think important to tell our listeners what you create in terms of the steps and the process involved in that lab is very, very believable, and it shows that you yourself have got some background in science. I believe your own studies were in genetics and biochemistry. Is that correct?
Yes, it was. It was. I have a BSc in biochemistry and genetics. I've actually never worked within that field. I've only worked in writing even after I finished university. And I think even with Bo's character as well, that sense of ambition he has at the beginning of the novel, with the idea that he's going to find something or discover something amazing. And I think that was maybe an ambition I had when I went to university and I studied a BSc. I thought I would get into a research project and I would discover something great.
Yeah.
And then when I left university and I wasn't able to do that, you then see Bo's ambition kind of deteriorating towards the end of the novel, and that was towards when I finished university. There's a lot of that in there as well.
On that note, I just want to share with listeners a quote from the book about Bo's struggle. I mean, Bo as a character, he has come from an extremely poor background. He is by far the most highly qualified member of his family already, and yet he struggles with this immense fear of not reaching his potential. And I related so to this quote, and I'm sure others will, that there was that deep fear that lay tucked away in the back of his mind, the one he ignored with great determination. It was a voice that whispered that maybe, just maybe, hard work couldn't replace being chosen. The nagging fear that said that above average was not genius. It said that Bo was missing something vital, a piece of intelligence, a spark of charisma, a drop of attractiveness. Maybe he was missing an untarnished life, free from death and poverty. That line resonated so much with me, and I think will with other readers, Sarah, that sense of that striving to always be better, that every time you achieve something, it's looking over your shoulder, what's next? Where's the next rung? Where do I go? I'm interested to hear whether you felt that sort of accumulation of the upward, the need to keep climbing upward, whether you felt it now that you've switched away from science and into a writing environment.
I really did. I really did. And it's also Bo's sense of confusion around the whole thing. I did a science course in high school. I studied science in university, and I was surrounded by people that were doing science and business and IT and these things. And when I was telling people that I was writing a novel, I guess nobody really understood what I was doing. And it's also that sense of confusion. And the only time that my writing had been looked at by somebody that who wrote or was a professional was when I sent my queries out for my novel. So the entire time I felt like I was kind of shooting in the dark.
Wow.
When I was writing. Yeah.
And as a matter of interest, I mean, you were very young when you were writing this, Sarah. How long did it take to find a publisher who would take it on? Or was it one of those stories that it landed straight away? Or did you go through the traditional story of the rejection letters and rewrites and trying again and almost putting it away in a bottom drawer?
So writing the novel was very difficult because I was working and studying while I was writing it. Sure. Writing was a real struggle for me. But getting it published was honestly the easiest thing I've ever done.
Gosh.
I queried, I think, one literary agency and three publishers. I got one rejection, and the literary agency also rejected me. And then I got a hybrid publishing deal, which I was sure I didn't want because I wanted to be published traditionally. And then Quella came in. It was a matter of months, really.
That is fantastic. There are not many authors who have the gift of that kind of experience, especially on a first novel. So it must speak a lot, I think, about the quality of the writing, Sarah. I mean, I don't want to give too much away of the plot line, but I think it is important to let our listeners know that, as we've referenced, it's about science that gets distorted by human ambition. And very much important to the story is the question of playing in the boundaries of between life and death and where life ends. And is it possible to identify the thing that is the sort of the core building block of life and to find a way to preserve that for future generations. And of course, that takes us into the boundaries of, well, is it acceptable to to push ethical band boundaries in the here and now if the outcome further down the road is going to be for the greater good, as they would say. What made you want to play in that particular space, Sarah, of those ethical, I guess it's a question of what is deemed acceptable collateral damage for long-term gain?
When I was in university, I think it was my second year, I did a module called Animal Physiology and Diversity, and we looked at the body of animals. And I did propose a question in one of the lectures about if there's an electrical charge that's charging our body, where does that come from? And the lecturer basically told me that that's the spark of life and nobody has the answer for that. And then I really, after that, kind of delved into a lot of psychology and philosophy and a lot of stuff like that. And I wanted to, I feel with my writing, I kind of want to marry the two. I want science, and I also kind of want a bit of a philosophical view on things as well with my writing. When it comes to ethics, I do think that, I don't agree with Dr. Evermore's actions. Yeah. By the end of the book, neither do I agree with Bose. And I think that's what I wanted for the novel. I wanted to show that the sacrifice isn't worth it.
Yeah.
Because both of them are basically ruined by it.
Absolutely. In search of something that began with such a pure intention, it's destructive mm-hmm. in its process and its nature and its impact on them. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say more than that because, of course, we must leave the plot for our listeners to unravel for themselves in the multiple timelines. Mm-hmm. But just to ask, really, I mean, it's been a struggle to write this book. I'm in absolute awe that you managed to do it while juggling studies and work and managing mental health challenges of your own. Congratulations. On what you have produced in the face of all of that struggle. Was it bad enough to make you want to stop, or is it so lovely to have the book out in the world that you're already plotting the next one? What's the plan from here, Sarah?
I absolutely love writing, and I have so many ideas, and I'm working on a lot of stuff at the moment as well, and I can't wait for you guys to see it.
Well, I look forward to it. Sarah, in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Congratulations again on the publication of A Remedy for Death, which listeners can find in all good bookstores, published by Quella Books and retailing at about 280 Rand a copy. Sarah Naidoo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Lovely to have you with us.